There'll be some kind of system for it.
The whole point of the system is that one cannot go back, surely. I signed a solemn contract. In any case, it was the right thing to do. I'm going, Tom.
When?
They didn't say. They gave me 3 days' pay and told me to await instructions. There'll be recruit training and an officer cadet course. Then I suppose I go wherever I'm needed.
This isn't some horrible joke.
I'm afraid not. Tom sat down on the floor beside his friend and stared around at the place.
The garret changed as he looked. Its devil-may-care medley of bric-a-brac was transformed now into banal juvenilia. As he watched, each carefully cultivated eccentricity, from the unswept floor to the scattered library books, shrugged off its enchantment until all that was left was an attic, flat in an unexceptional borough of London. The flat would revert to the landlady, their life to the world.
Oh, thought Tom. So it finishes as quickly as this. All the things we make exceptional are merely borrowed from the mundane and must without warning be surrendered to it.
I'm sorry for what I said about running off like schoolboys.
That's all right. A lot of them practically are. You should have seen the recruiting line. I'm 24 and I felt like the old man.
Tom swallowed. Do you think I should volunteer too?
Good God.
Why? Well, I mean, I honestly hadn't thought about it until now.
Alistair threw a balled up sheet of newspaper. You're made to be an educator, you old fool. Find a way to do your job again and then do it. If one could stash schoolchildren down a disused mine in Wales, then I'd insist you enlisted with me. But until then, I'd say that war isn't on your curriculum.
Tom was silent for a minute. Thank you.
I thought you might take it harder.
I will miss you.
You certainly will. You'll have no one to tell you to cheer up. That's why I'm giving you Gaius Julius Caesar. Every time you look at him, I want you to imagine him saying, Tom, for God's sake, cheer up.
Alistair whipped the cat around when he said this, so that it addressed Tom directly. He had sewn two large coat buttons over the sockets for eyes, and they were pearlescent and exuberantly mismatched, so that the effect was of a startling and demented supervision.
Well, I want you to have this, said Tom, giving Alistair the jar of jam.
Alistair peered at the label.
A crude etiquette. The famous vintage, the 39. I believe I shall lay it down.
We shall open it together at War's End, yes?
Tom looked at him.
Will you be all right? How should I know?
Sorry.
Christ, said Alistair. I'm sorry.
He lay on his back on the floor, holding the jam up to the skylight. Tea? Said Tom, after a while.
If you're making.
There's no more sugar, I'm afraid. Alistair said nothing. Tom watched the scarlet and the purple light shift across his friend's steady face. October 1939. Since Mary must neither bump into her mother nor anyone who conceivably might, she had a day to fill on her own. Autumn had come, with squalls of rain that doused the hot mood of the war. She walked along the embankment while the southwesterly blew through the railings where children used to rattle their sticks. In the playground at Kensington Gardens, the wind scoured the kiteless sky and set the empty swings rocking to their own orphaned frequency. How bereft London was, how drably biddable without its infuriating children. Here and there Mary spotted a rare one that the evacuation had left marooned. The strays kicked along on their own through the leaves, sea-lied and forlorn. When she gave an encouraging smile, they only stared back. Mary supposed she could not blame them. How else would one treat the race that had abducted one's playmates? The wind that buffeted her had already blown through half of London, accruing to itself the putery, mouldering scent of all missing things. Mary drew her raincoat tight and kept walking. In Regent's Park, the wind wrenched the wet yellow leaves from the trees. Horse chestnuts lay in their cases, grave with mildew. She supposed that nature had no provision for conkers beyond the earnest expectation that boys in knee shorts would always come, world without end, to take them home and to dangle them on shoelaces and to invest each one with brash and improbable hope. Mary found a cafe where she was not known and sat at the back of it, away from the steamed-up window. Over stewed tea, she took paper and pen from her bag to write to Zachary. Just writing the address made her fret. It was one of those villages in the faraway England that London never called to mind unless some ominous thing happened, a landslip or the birth of a two-headed foal, that brought its name into the newspaper. She did not know how parents could bear to ink such addresses onto letters for their children. Corfe Mullen, Clibbury Mortimer, Abinger Hammer. These, surely, were places of obfuscating mist and sudden disaster, from whence one knew nobody and of which one knew nothing. Places full of country folk, eerie and bulb-nosed, smeared with chicken blood on full moon nights.
Dear Zachary, I feel dreadful that I was not able to keep my promise to come with you, but I hope that you do understand the need for the evacuation.
She gnawed at the top of her pencil. Now that great solid London was blacked out and dug in, here was this awful silence that the wet wind couldn't disguise. Autumn had come, but the Germans hadn't, after all.
I trust you have found a good family to take care of you.
The wind rattled the cafe's windows, and in the absence of shrill voices she could hear the cutlery scrape as the couple in the corner chased peas around their plates. They were parents, of course they were. There was no other way to collect such intricate worry lines.
Are we quite sure we have done the right thing?
On every corner Mary had passed that day there had been posters explaining that the children should remain evacuated, that the greatest Christmas gift to Herr Hitler would be to bring them home into harm's way.
I am sure you are being jolly fearless.
Mary frowned and rubbed this out.
The authorities imagined that the individual was a glove, requiring only the animating hand of a slogan. She could almost see her father in some windowless room of the house, penning the script in committee.
All morning the damp southwesterly had caught at the corners of the new slogans and sent them flapping against the billboards, exposing the fossil seams of earlier exhortations in their sediment of paste.
Even though I was your teacher for only a week, I should like you to know that you are a blazing creature, despite being an absolute knave, and that I slightly miss teaching you. I trust things are going well for you, but just in case they are not, and if you can bear to hold your nose and make a promise to a silly woman who has already broken hers to you, then please guarantee me that you will write to let me know.
She signed the letter Miss North, tucked it into its envelope, and went out into the rain for a postbox. She was home at 5 as dusk fell. The front door swung open when her foot fell on the first of the steps that rose to it.
Thank you, Palmer, she said,
giving him her raincoat to hang.
How was teaching? Called her mother from the drawing-room.
Well, said Mary, you know children.
I only know you, darling, and I dare say they aren't all so maddening.
Mary popped her head through the drawing-room door.
I am fond of you too, mother.
Fortunately, I had Nanny whenever it got too realistic.
Where's Hilda? I saw her coat in the hall.
I made her go through to the scullery. I don't care how much good these cigarettes do to your chests. They are ruinous for the curtains.
They are slimming.
Her mother lowered her voice.
They are slimming you, darling. You must do the opposite to Hilda.
Perhaps she lights the wrong end.
Her life is a carousel of torpid men and toffee eclairs. I tell her she should volunteer for war work like you, or at least find a man who will.
She is fond of Jeffrey St. John.
as tripe is fond of onions, darling, but what a fright they look together in the pan.
Don't be mean about Geoffrey, Mother. He kisses rather well.
Her mother treated her to a knowing expression that Mary felt sure was pure bluff. It was how mothers carried on, after all, with a glint in the eye that implied a sure clairvoyance, and also that it was your turn to talk. This was the velvet rope mothers offered, enough silence to make a noose with. Mary breezed from the drawing-room, blowing a kiss on the way out. In the hallway, the familiar air of the house closed around her, the beeswax on the banisters, and the brasso that burnished the stair-rods. A hint of laundry on the boil. Somewhere far within, crockery clacked as a maid addressed the detritus of afternoon tea. Coal rumbled as it was decanted from scuttle to Perdonian. That evening, it seemed, the fires would be lit for the first time since March. In the scullery, Hilda was smoking by the small window.
"And what of wild intrigue?"
Mary grinned.
"I'm working on Tom. I shall telephone him again today. I'm sure he'll find me a post. I keep reminding him there are scads of children who haven't been evacuated."
Hilda mimed a hunchback with the twisted face of a lunatic.
"Oh, stop it," said Mary. "I see no reason why they shouldn't all be given a chance to learn. I just need to persuade Tom."
"He seems a drip, if you ask me. You go for dinners, you practically beg him to kiss you, yet he offers you neither his lips nor his patronage. I should move on."
"Yes, but he is a man, though, don't you see? You could knit one quicker than you can make one fit off the shelf."
"Move on, darling, before the drip-drip leaves you soaked."
"All it is that Tom is rather shy. When I'm with him, well, it's nice."
Hilda offered an eyebrow.
"No, really. Tom is lovely. What's he like?" "Thoughtful. Interesting. Compassionate."
"These are English words for ugly."
"Not at all. He's tall with soft brown eyes. He's quite gorgeous, and I don't think he has any idea, which is sweet."
"Don't forget you only care because he can offer you a job."
"Which I need, thanks to you dropping me in it."
"Well, it's your own fault if you won't tell the truth to your mother."
"Oh, but who does? You punish me too hard over one little kiss."
Hilda affected puzzlement.
"Kiss?"
"No. Oh, Hilda, don't say you are over it already. I just spent the whole beastly day in the rain doing my penance for the Geoffrey indiscretion."
Hilda yawned.
"Have Geoffrey, if you wish. He still flatly refuses to volunteer for the war."
"As do you."
"Which is why I need a man I can nobly support."
"In absentia, though."
"Oh, in furs."
"Tom won't sign up, and I admire it. He... well, it's just not him."
Hilda widened her eyes.
"Mary North."
Mary smiled.
"Well, and so what?
You are actually soft on the man."
"No, no, but he has, oh, you know, eyes, and he's tall, and, well, I think it's lovely that he thinks teaching is important, because I think so too."
"Since when?"
said Hilda.
"Since the moment they said I couldn't. Why must we do what we're told?"
"To keep life pleasant and convivial?"
"Says the girl smoking in the scullery. Why not say to Mother, 'I shall smoke in your drawing-room, and if you must replace those curtains, then do let me pick you out a pattern that is not so exquisitely vile.' She'd respect you for it."
"She'd never let me visit again."
"Which might force you to widen your circle of friends."
Hilda blinked.
"Oh," said Mary, "I didn't mean it like that. It's just that you're the way you are, and I'm the way I am."
"And you are determined to fall in love with Tom, apparently, just because it goes against all available grains."
"One dinner, one lunch, and three telephone calls. I hardly call it love."
"What do you call it? Do you want him to give you the teaching job, or do you want, you know, him?"
Mary bit her lip.
"Is both allowed?"
"If I said no, would you only go and do it?"
Mary took her arm.
"And we need to find you a nice soldier, do we?"
"An airman would do at a pinch. I draw the line at navy blue."
Nice girls do. I shall keep a lookout for you. Of course, it is quite ridiculous in any case. There is no actual fighting, is there?
God, no, said Hilda. They're nice in uniform, not battle dress.
November 1939. An artillery shell rose over Salisbury Plain and slowed in the rain at the zenith of its arc. Beneath it, the wide grasslands moved in a green blur that resolved, as the projectile slowed, into sedges and mosses heavy with rain. With the scream of a fresh start, the shell dropped from the sky and buried itself in the ooze. There was a deficiency in the impact fuse, and the shell did not explode. It lay in its pocket of black mud in the bed of a shallow ravine. Its mechanism trembled. The thing could barely contain itself. 3 miles distant, Alistair Heath stood in driving rain while a sergeant major screamed at him.
"What makes my grass grow?"
"Blood, blood, blood," the men replied.
"Whose blood?"
"The enemy's."
"Whose enemy?"
"The king's enemy." Alistair joined in the bayonet drill without enthusiasm. He had heard the shell falling, astray from the gunnery range. The first problem of war was that no one was any good at it yet. He could not help thinking of shells as things he had always collected with his sisters on the beaches at Lulworth and Bracklesham. When the instructors spoke of firing them, he could not help seeing the dumpy 3.7-inch howitzers projecting cockles and scallops in looping trajectories over a blue horizon. Invariably, the scallops, when he visualized them, were the jaunty little things from Botticelli's The Birth of Venus.
"Heath?"
"Yes?"
"Perhaps you believe yourself to be above all this? Are you giving this vital drill, Mr. Heath, 100% of your gracious concentration?"
"Oh, yes, absolutely."
"Oh, yes, absolutely what?"
Alistair could not think what the man was driving at.
"Yes, I am giving it my full attention."
"Yes, I am giving it my full attention what?"
The man was retarded.
The wind blew over the wide miles of Salisbury Plain, hateful and blasted, pocked with the charred metal twisted in the violent shapes it had cooled to. It was a southwesterly wind, wet with brine from the channel, sharp from the numb Purbeck hills. It had passed through no city and picked up nothing of the scent of men and their consolations. It slowed Alistair's brain and took the feeling from his fingers. And here the sergeant major stood, infrangible in the wind and the rain, as he had stood the whole fortnight now, with his chest puffed out and his stomach sucked in and his face vermilion with fury. Now he was staring at Alistair and still waiting, apparently, for him to say something.
"Oh," said Alistair, "I mean, sir."
The other men laughed. After a month, one shouldn't forget the word.
"What, sir?"
"I'm sorry?"
"What is the message that you are communicating to sir, sir?"
"Oh, I see," said Alistair. "Sorry. I am giving this exercise 100% of my attention, sir."
"That's better," said the sergeant major.
Alistair was glad the man felt that way. The bayonet drill resumed.
"What makes my grass grow?"
"Blood, blood, blood."
"I can't hear you, ladies. Whose bloody blood?"
"The enemy's blood."
"Whose horrible Nazi enemy?"
"The king's horrible Nazi enemy."
"Then kill the enemy. What do you suppose the pointy end is for? Do it to him before he does it to you."
The men roared, and the sand oozed in clotted clumps from the bags they stuck with their bayonets. Every wound Alistair drove into the wet sacking opened a corresponding rent in his morale. How he hated this. The indefatigable tyranny of the sergeant major and the insidious Salisbury chill that grew inside one like an infection after 2 weeks camped out under dripping canvas. Most of all, he hated the flicker of warmth that hatred gave you. You imagined the sergeant major on the point of your blade and felt a horrid little twitch at the thought of driving it home. He executed the bayoneting to the minimum standard that left the king's enemy eviscerated, and when it was over and the sergeant major blew the whistle, He took his rifle and walked off a little way. He unstrapped his helmet and let the rain wash the sand off his face. He threw his pack down on a tussock to keep it off the sudden ground, and ducked into its lee to light his pipe. The damp tobacco shivered in the bowl. The matches failed one by one. In bleak exhaustion, Alistair watched the last one stutter.
Need a light, Heath?
It was Duggan, the only man on the course from that indeterminate age the other side of 30. He was the one who used the standard-issue folding knife and fork to skin and bone the sardines from their ration tins, as if he were taking tea at Fortnum's. He held his rifle slightly away from his body when they marched, the way one might carry a child that had wet itself. "Thanks," said Alistair. With Duggan's cigarette lighter, it was easier. His pipe caught, and the mild blue smoke was a comfort. It blew, he supposed, towards London.
In the mood for company?
Said Duggan. Alistair eyed his pipe bowl.
I'm stuck for conversation after that drill.
Duggan sat on his own upturned pack.
If the wisdom of age may guide you, I pretend that the sandbag is just a sandbag.
Alistair looked up.
It bothers you too.
The way I see it, all the bloodthirsty shouting is more for the benefit of the men. You'll be an officer, I take it?
I hope so. I'm to begin a conversion course, assuming I get through this one without bayoneting the Sergeant Major.
Duggan got a cigarette lit.
I shouldn't think they'd necessarily mark one down for that. Anyway, I dare say officer training will be a more civilized business.
Alistair nodded.
They'll assemble us around a cheese board. The CO will ask, "What do we serve with this?" And as one we shall reply, "Port, port, port." "Whose port?" "The King's port," Alistair grinned. "We are officer material."
Duggan gave a wire-thin smile and used the hot end of his cigarette to trace the undulations of the plain.
"Don't you loathe this vile place?"
Alistair puffed at his pipe.
It was a paradise before the army took it over. Full of little hamlets bursting with cheerful cottages, every one of them with a roaring hot fire and a unicorn tethered outside.
Sounds like Peckham.
Is that where you're from?
Duggan shivered.
In the sense in which the human soul is eternal, no one is actually from Peckham. Some of us are living there pro tempore, so help us.
I'm north of the river, Camden.
Oh, the glamour. And what did you do up there before you began doing whatever the army tells you?
I was a very junior conservator at the Tate. I made tea and reminded the night cleaners not to use vim on the actual canvases.
One wonders how the nation will manage without you.
Oh, and I suppose you were the Archbishop of Canterbury.
I'm an actor. Oh, that stammer disappears on the stage.
And you signed up for this?
I was sick of being second murderer, and so here I am, rehearsing to be the first.
And how are you finding it? Costumes are rather drab, but there aren't many lines to learn. It's the one show you hope will never make it to the West End.
Amen.
Alistair tapped out his pipe on the side of his boot.
Miss London?
Duggan shook his head.
I didn't get through the bathing suit round.
Alistair smiled.
I miss being allowed to mind my own business.
Miss it too.
Are you married?
Duggan held up his cigarette and let the wind whip the ash away.
You really are young, aren't you?
In the southwest, the horizon was gone now, lost in a flat zinc mist. Above them, the base of the cloud was dropping, black cords of rain dragging it down. As the weather closed, the men occupied a shrinking remainder of the plain between the grass and the falling sky. The company exchanged the blackly comic looks of men about to be engulfed by worse of the same. The sergeant major blew his tin whistle.
"This coming in! Take note, you hopeless bastards! Take note!"
Duggan frowned.
"Take note of what exactly? Will that awful man never tire of being unhelpful?"
Alistair blew on his hands to warm them.
"What do you suppose he thinks we should be doing?"
"About the mist? Oh, we can hardly shoot it, can we? And yet they have issued us with these."
Duggan flicked the barrel of his rifle with a fingernail, making the dead note of a stopped bicycle bell.
"Do you suppose he means we should put on more clothes?"
"I know, we're wearing everything they gave us, aren't you?"
"Well, should we eat something then, to keep our energy up?"
"Did the Sergeant Major order us to eat anything? I don't think I could bear being bawled at again."
"We could use our initiative."
"Did he specifically order us to use our initiative?"
"I have some jam in my pack."
Duggan threw him a look.
"You've been lugging jam around? Isn't this standard issue suffering heavy enough for you?"
Alistair opened his pack and fished out Tom's jar.
"Blackberry. Been carrying it to remind me of home. I was saving it for the end of the war, but that's no use if one dies of misery in the meantime. Got a spoon or something we can eat it with?"
Duggan looked around.
"You won't laugh. I've some biscuits my dear mother baked."
Somewhere close, the sergeant major was yelling again, the words snatched and broken in the wind. Duggan took the biscuits from his pack. They were wrapped in a blue linen tea towel and tied with parcel string. Now, with a silent rush, the mist washed over the company and the plane vanished entirely. Nothing was visible outside the tight globe each man crouched in. They sprawled on their packs, smoking and talking in low, tired voices, answering the encircling greyness with the blank orbs of their eyes. Alistair's thoughts stalled. After a fortnight of this sour cold and this enervating wind and this incessant Sergeant Major, his fatigue ran so deep that only the sight of the wide plain had convinced him of his own residual magnitude. Now he felt snuffed and extinguished. He blew on his hands and waited for the whistle to sound, and an order to be given that would invest him once more with purpose. Duggan was working at the knot that tied the biscuits in their blue cloth. His fingers stopped as the light gained a darker inflection. Two boots sank into the mud between Alistair and Duggan. The two men looked up.
"Oh, well, isn't this delightful? These two London gentlemen have come to the countryside for a picnic."
Grey forms converged in the mist. They turned into men that Alistair recognised, their faces variously animated by apologetic solidarity or leering glee. He stood. Duggan drew himself up more slowly, first placing his parcel carefully on top of his pack.
"Satisfied, Duggan?"
Duggan nodded.
"Yes, Sergeant Major."
"That parcel positioned entirely to your liking, is it?"
Quite, thank you, Sergeant Major."
Without breaking eye contact with Duggan, the Sergeant Major nudged the package off its perch and smashed it into the ground with his boot. He ground it under his heel until it was half submerged in the mud.
"And now?"
Duggan looked down at the muddy tea towel and the shattered biscuits dissolving in the rain. He raised his eyes to the Sergeant Major's.
"Now your wife will have to bake me some more biscuits, Sergeant Major. I can pick them up next time I'm with her."
The company sucked in its breath. The Sergeant Major rocked back on his heels and smiled, slowly, in a leer that exposed the teeth to their roots. The wind whipped at the men's rain jackets.
"Very good, Duggan," said the Sergeant Major finally.
It was the first time any of the company had heard him use a normal speaking voice. He retreated and crouched beside his own pack, downwind, to communicate with parties unknown over the field radio. Now the company clustered around. Once they were sure the episode was over, and the Sergeant Major's attention otherwise engaged, a few of them shook Duggan's hand. A cigarette was offered, and lit for him when it was clear that his own hands were shaking too badly to do it. Alistair watched how the men acted with Duggan, chummily, though ready to disperse if the Sergeant Major should return in wrath. They did not yet know the ways of the army. Whether rebesting once acknowledged was forgotten, or whether grudges were held over things like this. There were nervous laughs. No one attempted a reenactment of the incident. They waited, nervously, in the fog. A chance agglomeration of greengrocers and machinists and accounting clerks, rifles slung. From a little way off, Alistair watched them with a tired apprehension. His pipe was far beyond relighting now, his fingers stiff and unfeeling. He retrieved Tom's jam from the mud, wiped the jar off, and replaced it in his pack. He should be at the garret now, eating the damn jam with a spoon. It was a struggle, with one's body shivering right down into the deep muscle, to concentrate on staying as dry as one could, and not simply bursting into tears. Dusk came, and with it the rumble of an engine. A canvas-backed lorry, its slotted lights throwing a demure downward glance in the mist. It drew up, engine running. An orange glow from the cab, the driver smoking. The Sergeant Major jumped up on the bonnet to address them.
Right, you lucky lads. This weather isn't looking too clever, and since I am a benevolent god, I'm treating you all to a nice warm night in barracks. Packs on, hop in now, and don't say Daddy isn't good to you.
The men cheered. Alistair wrestled his stiff limbs over the tailgate and collapsed into the laughing crush of men on the benches in the back of the lorry. The man to his left slapped him on the back and offered him a dry cigarette. Alistair smoked it wolfishly. With an ache so terrible that it was funny, the feeling returned to his hands and feet. All around him now, the company bent to the task of complaining. Their faces lit erratically in the drawing glow of cigarettes. The men named the plane an evil place, and enumerated the bodily modifications and inventive sodomies they would vest upon the person of Adolf Hitler at War's End for causing them to have spent winter weeks on Salisbury, when, after all, they were handsome young men with important peacetime work to do, such as drinking and philandering, and sleeping both of those things off. They called the army an arse hat, and its brass hats brass arseholes. They denounced the ice wind blowing through the canvas canopy, and they cursed the hardness of the lorry's metal benches. They articulated the opinion that the optimal stowage location for those benches would be up the arse of the lorry driver, to whom it was pointed out that the small effort of bringing seat cushions with him from barracks might have been a nice touch. Next, they insulted the bootmakers, who had made the boots they all wore, which were constructed entirely of hate, and which kept the freezing water in, but not out. These boots were to be shoved up the bootmakers' asses. Now the men expressed the hope that the presumed designers of the Lee Enfield Mark III rifle might experience, when urinating, defecating or ejaculating, a blockage of the same unshiftable cussedness that the men had experienced when prone in the frozen mud of the firing range and trying with numb fingers to persuade the magazine to surrender a bullet to the breech. It was decided that all the bootmakers, with the boots already in situ up their arses, should be put up Lee and Enfield's arses, the left bootmakers up Mr. Lee's, and the right bootmakers up Mr. Enfield's. Finally, Lee and Enfield should be inserted headfirst up each other's arses, since they were so very keen on breech loading. There was nothing the military had that the men did not believe would be more properly stowed within the concavities of other personages, animals or objects. There, in the budding warmth in the back of the lorry, while their wet clothes steamed and a canteen of spirits was passed from hand to hand, the men squared the whole army away, calibrating every one of its tyrannies and stowing it like a Russian doll up the arse of the next smallest tyranny, until the whole great apparatus of war seemed certain to find its inevitable resting place deep within the German Führer's fundament. In short, the men were happy. From the litany of their grievances, only the Sergeant Major was absent, since it was his intervention that had gifted this sudden warmth and this freeing of tongues. Alistair had to hand it to the magnificent bastard. He was not without genius. Over 2 frightful weeks he had driven the company to the brink, and then, sensing desertion or mutiny, he had sidestepped like a matador. Now, as the wind outside rose to gale force, the sergeant-major sat aloof in the cab with the driver, letting the company vent, his power over them doubled by his act of magnanimity. Alistair made himself comfortable on the bench and drank from the canteen when it was passed to him. The men were all right. They had been pushed to their limit, and if there had been nothing particularly exalting about how they had all reacted, then his own behaviour had been unexceptional too. They passed him the drink with no distinction. Maybe this was more than he had a right to expect. As the warmth spread through him, and they all waited for the lorry to drive off, Alistair let himself relax. Now that the need for alertness was gone, he was drowsy. He hadn't realised, until now, quite how exhausted he had become. His eyes closed. The cheerful, complaining voices lost their distinctness. They merged with the idling note of the engine and the roar of the wind without. He snapped awake when the tailgate of the lorry banged open. From the startled expletives of the company, he understood that some of them had drifted off too. A cold blast blew in as a flap of canvas was drawn back. The sergeant-major shone a torch. The men winced and screwed up their eyes as the beam danced over them and came to rest on Duggan.
"Out you hop, Duggan. There's a good chap," said the sergeant-major.
"Excuse me," said Duggan.
The only sound was the soft chugging of the lorry's engine.
"Hard of hearing. I say again, Mr. Duggan."
Pausing only to gather up the kit with which His Majesty the King, in his generosity, has seen fit to issue you, make like a bunny rabbit and hop, hop, hop out of this lovely truck.
Well, what?
You will make your way to barracks on foot, Duggan. Night navigation exercise, you lucky man. Pulled your name out of the hat at random, so help me God.
Duggan did not move.
Well, come on, Duggan. What are you waiting for? Every minute you sit there on your arse is a minute you're keeping these soldiers from their steak and ale pies and their hot baths and their beds.
But I don't know how to get to barracks.
Barracks is in war, Mr. Duggan, exactly where we left it.
I know where barracks is. I don't know where we are.
The sergeant major leered. The loose flap of canvas set up a volley of sudden claps as a gust caught the lorry, rocking it on its springs.
Do you, or do you not, Mr. Duggan, have in your possession one copy of the map with which you were all issued, Mr. Duggan, His Majesty's Ordnance Survey, 6" to 1 mile, England-Wiltshire:052?
Yes, but I don't know where we are on it.
Did you, or did you not, Mr. Duggan, when I warned you that the mist was closing in, use the last visibility to take bearings with your Mark II hand-bearing compass and lanyard, then transfer those bearings onto the aforementioned map as per your training, Mr. Duggan, in order to triangulate your position?
No, Sergeant Major.
Oh, said the sergeant-major reflectively. Could be a long night for you, then. Never mind, lesson learned. Come along now, out you hop.
Duggan's face blanched in the hard disk of torchlight the sergeant-major kept him pinned in. His eyes were red.
You can't do this.
The sergeant-major said nothing and kept the torch trained. Duggan appealed to the company.
He can't do this. He can't single me out.
Alistair could not watch Duggan's face, urgent with expectation, falling when nothing came back from the other men. There was only a soft scraping of boots on the wooden floor of the lorry as positions were adjusted.
Duggan, said the sergeant-major, I can understand that you may not wish to do this alone. So, let me give you a choice. If you're not out of this vehicle in 30 seconds, then everyone will get out, and the whole company will march back to barracks with you. Is that what you want, Mr. Duggan?
Duggan was dazzled by the bean.
I...
There was silence for 5 seconds, then 10. In the dark, a man coughed and stretched it into a muttering. The hard guttural of the cough disguised the initial consonant.
Red out.
A pause, then more coughing from the men in their darkness.
Get out.
Get the hell out of here. Get the bloody hell out, Duggan, you useless bastard.
The men coughed their judgment. Each damnation blent with a paroxysm of the diaphragm, so that the men spoke not only with their tongues, but also with their tired bodies that were scourged and sleepy and did not want to go back out into the storm. Alistair did not join in, but though he wished they would stop, he did nothing. Duggan turned to him, or almost to him. Blinded in his small circle of light, he addressed a place slightly to Alistair's right. In a small voice, on the edge of cracking, he said,
Heath?
And then, when no answer came,
Alistair?
Alistair clutched his arms tight around himself. He heard the roaring of the gale and felt the fragile warmth within him. He would be so quickly struck back to numbness if he went out into it all again. He made himself look at Duggan. The man had a strangely flat face, almost concave. It was a weak face, Alistair saw this now, and wondered why he hadn't noticed before. It would not be a difficult one to take aversion to.
If I had a face like that, Alistair thought, I should probably have learned by his age to be more careful who I was rude to.
Alistair looked at the weak, beseeching face and felt a surge of anger. This was a man he had spoken with for only a few minutes, and who therefore had no claim to fraternity. They had exchanged a few witticisms, that was all. They had sat out of the wind for a moment, enjoying a solidarity which, now he came to think of it, had been rather smug, and based on the understanding that they were cut from finer cloth than the other men. And now here he was, warmed by those other men's whisky.
Alistair?
The wind whipped at the canvas. The men waited on his word. But Alistair did not want to go back out into the storm, and so, in the darkness, he said nothing. In the spotlight of the torch, Duggan's pleading look softened into misery, and then dissolved entirely. Finally, as he took his pack and rifle and clambered towards the tailgate, Duggan, the actor, was expressionless. The lorry lifted on its springs and settled again as his weight dropped over the back. The sergeant-major extinguished his torch and slammed the tailgate shut. Alistair felt the lorry rock again as the sergeant-major climbed into the cab. Then the door slammed and the lorry lurched as the driver set it in motion over the tussocks of grass. In the back, all of them sat in silence, as the lorry picked up a lurching, jolting speed over the trackless plain. No one joked now, or swore, or passed whiskey. Now each man alone in his sodden clothes weighed the warmth of the things he had gained against the cost of them, and since the price had been paid by all of them acting together, it was best now if they all sat alone. Rain roared against the canvas and entered in chill streams wherever it found ingress. The wind blew knives.
"Damn it," said Alistair.
He took up his rifle and pack, gripped the steel hoops of the canvas top to keep his balance, and stumbled over the legs and packs of the men to reach the back of the lorry bed. He braced, then launched himself over the tailgate. The fall winded him. He lost his equipment. He rolled over in the sodden grass, coming to rest jackknifed and gasping. 20 minutes of warmth had been enough to make him forget the nature of cold completely. Straight away, he doubted whether he could survive. He picked himself up and stumbled in a half-crouch, with his back to the gale, as he retrieved first his pack and then his gun. The rain beat on his bare head. His helmet was gone. His rifle was slick with rain. He shouldered the awful thing. The lorry did not slow or change its note, and he did not expect it to. In the back, they would all be feeling the lifting of a burden now. The remaining men would be talking again, and promising to stand pints for the man that had gone over. They would not all be certain of his name. Alistair watched the slit beams of the taillights disappear and set his back to their direction. He retraced the track they had driven, estimating the distance and the time. As he went, leaning into the gale, he shouted for Duggan. The stars were nowhere. The night was furiously dark. 3 miles to the west, the unexploded shell trembled at the approach of the lorry. Through the soil, beneath the roar of the wind, the vibrations came softly at first. As the sound drew closer, it resolved into the groaning of leaf springs and the grinding of the overwrought transmission. Closer still, the bass rumble of the lorry was louder than the moaning of the gale. The impact fuse almost triggered. In the back of the lorry, the soldiers were singing an Al Bowley number. The soldiers' voices lurched as the lorry swayed. There was the thin metal sound of a harmonica, setting up an answering oscillation in the cold brass jacket of the artillery shell. Men were beating time with their boots on the floor of the lorry. The reverberations filled the soil as the rumble approached, almost over the top of the shell now. The lorry was 10 yards away from the shell. Down in the wet earth, the points of the impact fuse buzzed and rattled and came in contact with each other and exerted a pressure that was almost enough. The lorry came closer. Nearly underneath it now, the shell vibrated with every nuance. The secondary rhythm that the sergeant major tapped out on the dashboard, slightly out of time. His cheerful swaying, now that the men could not see him. The pop of the small chain cork as he shared his hip flask with the driver. The asymmetry of the load where the men huddled in the back on the less drafty side. The squeal as the wet fan belt slipped. The flatulence of the soldiers as it was transmitted through the long, hard benches and broadcast through the treaded rubber tyres and into the saturated earth. The men sang and the lorry drove directly over the top of the shell, the wheels passing to each side and missing it completely. It settled a little deeper in the cold mud as the vibrations diminished again. The men drove on to barracks, unaware that everything was new. It was not as if the army issued them each with a stopwatch that started again from zero each time they were spared. Even if the army did, the watch would not have operated reliably, and the men would have earmarked an arsehole to stow it in. 3 miles to the east, the ground surprised Alistair by falling away, so that he had to accelerate to keep his footing. In the dark, he ran blindly down the slope and found Duggan by tripping over him, bringing a yell of shock. He stopped and leaned on his rifle, panting.
Duggan?
Who is it?
It's me, Heath.
Alistair?
He crouched, using his hands to establish the orientation of Duggan's body. He was on his back, just off perpendicular to the slope, with his head uphill. Alistair's best guess at the terrain was that they were close to the base of a shallow draw. Water ran noisily in what must be its base.
Are you hurt?
I don't know. I fell.
Alistair felt down Duggan's sides. Your legs are in the water.
Are they? I can't feel them.
Come on, let's get you out of there.
He unstrapped his pack, settled it on the slope, then took Duggan under the arms and heaved him clear of the water.
There, he said. Are you all right?
As an actor, I'm tremendous.
Where's your pack?
I don't know.
Where's your gun?
It's called a rifle, Heath. You should know better.
Where the hell is it?
The gale moaned above the lip of the draw.
I don't know. I'm sorry, Alistair.
Don't be, you fool.
He put himself between Duggan and the wind.
The sergeant major kicked you out too, I suppose.
Something like that.
He really is an abysmal bastard. I could have him barred from every club in Soho.
Alistair helped Duggan to a sitting position. Can you stand?
I can try.
Alistair held him until the feeling came back into the man's legs and he could stay up on his own.
Shall we go?
If you think you can walk.
It might not exactly be what you would call marching.
You must just do your best. Here, hold my arm. They struggled to the lip of the draw. The wind rediscovered them and sent them staggering until they found their balance and leaned into it.
"Don't get separated," shouted Alistair. "I'll never find you again."
"Have you your compass? I've lost everything."
Alistair felt for it on the lanyard around his neck and brought it before his face.
"I can't see it."
"And how do we know the way?"
shouted Duggan.
"It's dark as miner's lungs."
Alistair yelled into his ear.
"This wind is southwest. Barracks are more or less west, I think. If we keep the wind on our left, between our nose and our shoulder, I think we can get ourselves there."
They struggled forward, with the gale contesting every step. Their saturated clothes clung to their skin, making another resistance to be fought against. The sodden ground sucked each footfall down and hated to let it rise. They persevered for an hour, then two, with Duggan's hand growing heavier all the time on Alistair's shoulder. Alistair took the windward side and sheltered the man all he could, but Duggan began to fall silent. Alistair was weakening too. From the darkness before them came strange coloured flashes, which might have been real or might not. Fragments of songs and advertising slogans played in his ears, so clear that it was hard to believe he was not hearing them.
"Brill cream your hair. She likes it that way."
He shook his head to clear it.
"Lovely day for a Guinness."
He forced himself back into the reality of it, wind on his left cheek, guiding Duggan over the worst of the uneven ground. For a while it worked. He raised one boot, then the other, then one boot, then the other. Then,
"They're jolly well taking daily Bovril."
A gust caught him in the face and snapped him awake. He found himself motionless, with Duggan leaning against him. He didn't know for how long the two of them had been standing like that, asleep on their feet. He shook Duggan alert and called a rest, and the two of them ducked into the poor shelter of a hillock that they sensed rather than saw. They put their backs to the slight slope and drew up their knees. Now that they had stopped, the cold was frightening.
"Duggan?"
There was no answer. Alistair shook him.
"Duggan? We can't sleep. We'll fall unconscious."
A short pause.
"Well, that would never do. What would the sergeant major do without us?"
"He'd probably be court-martialed for leaving us out here."
"And I'm tempted to die just to spite him."
"That's the spirit that will win us the war."
"How far now, do you think?"
Alistair thought about it. His best guess was that the company had been 6 or 7 miles east of barracks when the lorry had come. He was reasonably sure that the two of them had walked in the right direction, but it was impossible to know at what rate. At times they had hardly made progress at all. They had travelled perhaps 2 or 3 miles in as many hours, and they had between 3 and 5 more miles still to go.
"Not long at all now," he said. "Another hour should do it."
"Jolly good," said Duggan. "I have more of those biscuits back at the barracks, you know."
"Fine," said Alistair. "That will be just the ticket."
"Steady on, old boy. I never said I would share them."
Alistair grinned, feeling the stretch in his numb cheeks for the first time in hours. He stood with difficulty, shouldered his pack and rifle, then felt for Duggan's hand to pull him to his feet.
"Come on, you old dog. Let's get you back to your kennel."
They set out into the gale again, struggling forward with heavy boots. Now, at last, came the longed-for hint of dawn. It came slowly, this restitution of shape to the world. With the clouds so thick and the sun still below the horizon, it did not seem that the light came from any one origin, but rather that the near tussocks and the distant berms and their own outstretched hands all glowed, each with their own pale effusion. It seemed like something holy.
Even the wind relented and began to drop with the dawn. The rain slowed to a drizzle, and the venom went out of it. In the feeble light, they came across parallel tracks with freshly cut tyre marks in the wet sedge. Now they had only to follow the lorry home. Both men understood, then, that they were saved. They looked at each other and smiled shyly, knowing that they would make it now, and that their friendship, formed in the darkness, would carry on into the light. Duggan found his strength again. He no longer needed to hang on to Alistair's shoulder, and they walked side by side and made quicker progress into the west. The rain stopped entirely, and the wind dropped. The base of the cloud began to rise. From beneath the earth, the sun came up, red and ancient, contracting and brightening as it rose at their backs. Their long shadows preceded them across the plain.
"My boots are killing me," said Duggan with a grin. "I miss comfy shoes. Are you for Chelsea's or Pumps?"
"I'm a loafer who favours a brogue."
"I like a good heel on a shoe, and I don't care for those fussy leathers like pigskin or calfskin. Just give me something that can take a decent shine. I don't mind as far as the colour goes. Black is all right, I suppose, but tan is fine too, and even a beige or..."
He stepped on the unexploded artillery shell, and it tore him apart.
November 1939. At barracks, Alistair kept returning to awareness to find himself engaged in some activity. Showering, or shaving, or eating green soup and white rolls in the naffy. Men of all ranks came and talked at him, soundlessly, and from their demeanour he tried to gauge which were offering consolation and which were giving orders. Officers seemed to be waiting for him to say something. He tried, "Sir," but it did not make them leave him alone. The explosion had deafened him. At dinner, a single drop of blood splashed down beside his bowl, and he stared until he understood that it had come from him. He traced its point of origin to his ear. Embarrassed, he left the table with his food untouched. Alone in the dormitory, with his hearing beginning to return, he opened his locker. There was to be a kit inspection at dawn, there always was, and his equipment was a state. He balled up newspaper, stuffed it into his boots, and stood them on the paraffin heater. It was against regulations, and Alistair knew that if the sergeant-major saw it, he would say,
"The regulations are there for a reason. What if everyone put their boots to dry on top of this paraffin heater?"
And Alistair, along with the other men present, would be required to suppress the answering voice that said, "Everyone would have dry boots." Alistair folded his two dress shirts into regulation rectangles and squared them away in the top left position in the locker, with the collar side at the back and the forward edge parallel to the edge of the metal shelf and one exact quarter inch back from it. Some fellow sufferer in history had scored a line into the metal shelf of the locker to facilitate the alignment. This was the only humanizing decoration that Alistair had found in the barracks. In the caves of Lascaux, he had seen aurochs and megaloceros daubed in mineral paint. In the restoration rooms of the Tate, he had held his breath over Turner's brushwork. He took off his trousers to fold them, and found an envelope in the pocket. The post had come during the day, clearly, and he must have lined up with the other men to receive it. There had been so many lines that day. Armoury, brigadier's office, laundry, infirmary. He had handed in his rifle, his report, his clothes, his body, until there was nothing left to surrender, and he had been dismissed to light duties. He opened the letter. "Dear Alistair, I, Caesar, have been keeping an eye on Tom for you. Or rather, I have been keeping a rather fetching mother-of-pearl coat button on him, since that was what you saw fit to acquit me with. I have much to report, so pin back your ears. After all, you did pin back mine. Since you left for pastures more exciting, your flatmate has seen his own existence considerably enlivened. You know that I disapprove of humans and their laughable choices of mate, but in this case, even I must admit that your friend Tom has picked a corker. Mary North is the loveliest thing I have ever seen, despite her damnable lack of tail and whiskers, and her strange habit of walking on her hind legs. Alistair put down the letter and went over to the paraffin stove.